Welcome. Thank you, too, to Kathy and the board of the Friends of Jung, who do a lot of work behind the scenes to make this sort of thing possible. I mean, they devote days and days to this sort of stuff. So thank you very much for all your help. You all got a handout. We will be working with Answer to Job. I hope you are able to bring a copy. If not, you can follow along. You just won't be able to make notes in your book. We will also be, I will be referring to this, and I don't assume you have it, but if you want to spend the money, it's well worth it. I just heard Carol saying that it's hard to find. The problem with all of Inner City Books is their U.S. distributor went bankrupt. So you have to order it from them directly if you want to get it quickly. Amazon will carry it. I don't know what the deal is. I think Amazon must get in like a couple at a time, and then they sell them, and then they don't have them. So it looks like they're not available, but they should be. If you go to innercitybooks.net, you can buy anything. I hope they resolve it, because one of my books is what they're selling, and it's hard to sell books if you can't buy them.
But also, if you need to order from Inner City and they want to be working
directly, yes. We make a little money on that, which the group certainly can probably. So today we'll be going through Answer to Job. It's the one book Jung wrote that he was happy with. He would have written everything else, he would have rewritten everything else except this one. We'll talk a little bit about that. It's not easy. I will first try to explain the text and then show you, which is, I think, its real value, what its clinical importance is. It's Jung's attempt to understand trauma. I know it doesn't say it, but if you know how to read between the lines, we'll see that's what it's about. I'm going to be shuttling back and forth between the book and Edinger and a couple other books. But if you just follow along with Answer to Job, that's fine. On the little guide I gave you, I did mark for all the major paragraphs we'll be talking about where Edinger talks about them. So if you want to go home, if you ever buy the book and you want to compare what we've talked about in the book with what the study guide says, I've tried to cross-reference the pages for you. I got to tell you, without Edinger's study guide, I wouldn't have understood this. It's very obscure. But I'll try to explain why all that is. So let's just get started. We will work through the text. When you're kind of familiar with the story, I brought along Blake's illustrations of the Book of Job. We'll talk about those. Edinger has published a book on that, which is what I'm going from, Encounter with the Self. A Jungian commentary on William Blake's illustrations of the Book of Job. Then we'll just go through the text. I've tried to pick out the major sentences in the text so that just by spending four and a half hours, you'll have some idea what he's talking about. And then I brought along a dream which I think illustrates what the book is talking about. So we will pick up on, depending on your edition, either page Roman numeral 9 or paragraph 357. Page 357. If you have the paperback, it's Roman numeral 9. If you have the hardback, it's page 357. Second paragraph on page Roman numeral 9 or 357. The most immediate cause of my writing the book is perhaps to be found in certain problems discussed in my book, Ion. Those of you who have done this workshop on Ion, you're set. Especially the problems of Christ as a symbolic figure and of the antagonism Christ-Antichrist represented in the traditional zodiacal symbolism of the two fishes. If you remember Ion, Jung does a historical analysis of the last 2,000 years of Western history.
Are they coming to us?
No. His view of Western history is there's a first phase marked by the beginning of Christianity in which the God image, Christ, was depicted as light and good and spiritual. That left necessarily a hole in the human heart because human nature is not only light and good and spiritual. So the part of human nature that was not symbolized by that first image of Christ in the first 1,000 years took its revenge in the second 1,000 years and began pressing the human psyche to move us in the direction of worldly exploration. So a first spiritual phase, a second worldly phase. What was also not symbolized in that image of Christ was evil. So you've got the devil and Christ, or you've got the Antichrist and Christ. What the book of Job deals with is what is the nature of evil? What's the nature of that reality which Christianity has marginalized as either the devil or completely devoid of any representation in the Godhead? So Jung felt he had to turn back to that problem after raising it an ion and probe more exactly what is evil. Another way to put it is this essay is going to be about what is the effect on people who have experienced evil. What happens to those people who have been abused, tortured, have had their been an attempt for their lives to be taken, and so on? All of that, Jung felt, was implied but not totally addressed in his other works. A little bit about Jung's writing it. Roman numeral 10, if you have the paperback, page 358, if you have the hardback. If you go to the last paragraph, go down 2, 4, 6 sentences. But I was gripped by the urgency and difficulty of the problem and was unable to throw it off. Therefore, I found myself obliged to deal with the whole problem, and I did so in the form of describing a personal experience carried by subjective emotions. I think that's the first thing to remember. This book was written out of subjective emotions. Normally, Jung tried to be objective in his writing. Here, he is completely subjective. So that explains a lot about the style. It's almost a rant. I deliberately chose this form because I wanted to avoid the impression that I have any idea of announcing an eternal truth. So he's giving his subjective confession to his experience, basically in the analytic practice, and I think more generally in life, of those people who have had to deal with evil. A couple other places he talks about it. Now I'm going to, I think in the paperback, it is marked by paragraph, is it not, after this? So, if you go to paragraph 559. The third sentence down, since I shall be dealing with numinous factors, my feelings challenged quite as much as my intellect. I cannot, therefore, write in a coolly objective manner. but must allow my emotional subjectivity to speak. If I want to describe what I feel when I read certain books of the Bible, or when I remember the impressions I've received from the doctrines of our faith. I do not write as a biblical scholar, which I am not, but as a layman and physician who has been privileged to see deeply into the psychic life of many people. What I'm expressing is, first of all, my own personal view. And then on 561, paragraph 561, if you go down to the bottom of that page and go up three lines, I shall not give a cool and carefully considered exegesis that tries to be fair to every detail, but a purely subjective reaction. In this way, I hope to act as a voice for many who feel the same way I do. The story goes that Jung wrote this in a fever. He was he went to bed with a fever, and he told Esther Harding that he saw a little imp sitting on his bedpost who dictated the essay to him. And when he was finished writing, fever was passed. So it's literally written in a fever. So that, I think, should give us some reason to be alert to the style and to try to peer beneath it for the psychic reality that it's trying to grasp. A little bit about the effect of this work on those who read it. Now I'm going to go to Edinger. I don't assume you have this, so you can just listen, and if you do want to ever buy the book, you can follow up with this later. This is Edinger's study guide, page 15. This is from a letter of Jung's. Edinger is quoting to Neumann, who didn't like the book, by the way. He says, Jung says, I could no longer consider the average reader. Rather, he has to consider me. Edinger says parenthetically, this is why it is so hard for us to understand the answer to Jung, you see, because this is the attitude he's writing out of. I had to pay this tribute to the pitiless fact of my old age. With the undimmed prospect of all-around incomprehension, I could exercise no suasions and no currying favor. There was no hope of funneling knowledge into fools. So he just wrote this as he felt it, and it's up to us to really, I think, meet him more than halfway. Where he did try in his other works to meet the reader halfway, here he does not. As I mentioned, this is the one work that Jung was satisfied with. Let's take a look at a summary of the Book of Job and just a bird's eye view of what Jung's going to do with it. And then we'll go through it in more detail. So this is kind of a preview for the show. I'm in Edinger, page 28. So here's a rough outline of the Book of Job. There's a wager in heaven between Satan and Yahweh as to whether or not Job can be turned away from God. Kind of a heavenly conspiracy. So Satan says to Yahweh, you know, Job worships you, but it's only because his life is going well. Give Job a hard time, you'll see what he's really like. Job is then beset with multiple calamities. Job then questions his situation. Why is this happening to me? He calls out to God to explain to him why this is happening, to justify to him the reason for it. He says he's not an evil man, and his life, his behavior, does not in justice warrant this kind of treatment. Counselors arrive on the scene who tell him, in effect, to quit questioning what's beyond him and just submit and admit that though he may not understand it, God is just. But Job refuses. He perseveres in his questioning and in maintaining his integrity, as he puts it. And then finally, Yahweh manifests. He shows himself in the whirlwind, and in his great final speech, he says, in effect, who are you to question me? Look at all my grandeur. And with that, Job is silenced and accepts the situation. And Yahweh then restores all his property better than before. That's the bare bones of the biblical account. Here's what Jung is going to make of it in a nutshell. Page 19.
This is in
the study guide. Edinger. Oh, yeah. Okay. Five lines down on the second section of that page. This, of course, is completely heretical. Since Yahweh treated Job unjustly, and since that fact was registered consciously by Job, the crime that Yahweh committed against Job on account of his unconsciousness required rectification, required an answer. And Jung tells us in the book that Yahweh's answer to his unjust treatment of Job was his incarnation in man. Since his encounter with Yahweh, Job, as the image of humanity, had displayed a consciousness superior to Yahweh's. Yahweh was obliged to catch up with him morally, so to speak, and the answer for Yahweh was to become man. So the traditional interpretation is that the book shows that God knows better. Up against Yahweh, Job finally capitulates, and the lesson of the book is don't question because God knows better. Jung's response to that, as we'll see, and we'll be laying this argument out all day. This is just the preview. Is if you're looking down the barrel of a howitzer, what are you supposed to say? That's no moral victory for Yahweh. That is a beast beating up a small creature. And that was Job's only choice, but it was not the lesson of the book. The lesson of the book follows in the subsequent books where we see of the Bible, which we see the preparation for the birth of Christ. So that the real meaning of the book of Job, Jung is trying to argue, is in the subsequent books. And Job standing up to Yahweh, even though he finally gave up out of sheer desperation, produced a change in Yahweh. So that the theme of this book will be the transformation of the God image. Now, that's the biblical side. Let's look at how we are going to interpret this psychologically, because we're taking this as a myth. As a story with a psychological lesson for us. Edinger is now distilling what's an answer to Job, again in sort of a preview way, so we can have some sense of where we're going. Here's how Edinger puts it on page 29 of the study guide. Now this story is the prototype of what I call the Job archetype, which pictures a certain typical encounter between the ego and the self. So here, Yahweh will represent that aspect of the self which we have to deal with under certain circumstances. And you can imagine the circumstance is abuse. Edinger says, I distinguish four chief features of the Job archetype. First, there's an encounter between the ego and the greater power. So whenever an individual has been subject to a greater, overwhelming, and destructive power, that's what this book is about, psychologically. So rape, child abuse, attempted murder, torture, so on. A wound or a suffering of the, second point, a wound or a suffering of the ego results from the encounter. So you're attacked outwardly, generally, which we'll see produces an attack inwardly. And you're wounded. Now, here comes the big point. The ego perseveres in insisting upon scrutinizing the experience in search of its meaning. It will not give up in despair or cynicism, but perseveres in the assumption that the experience is meaningful. Then he refers actually to my favorite Bible story. This corresponds to Jacob's refusal to release the angel that he's wrestling with until he receives a blessing. Remember, the angel broke his hip. And this ego attitude corresponds also to Job's insistence on thinking that he knows that his Redeemer lives, even though he's being mistreated. Fourth point of this archetype or process. As a result of that, a divine revelation takes place by which the ego is rewarded with insight into the nature of the transpersonal psyche. And it will be an insight that satisfies the ego. It answers the question in some form or another and brings acceptance. Now we get to the practical relevance in this next sentence. Now, this full sequence can take place only if it isn't short-circuited by a personalistic or reductive interpretation at step three. If you say, I deserved it, or this is my karma, or, you know, my parental complex set me up for this, you will inhibit the manifestation of the self. So you see, what Jung is laying out is a totally different way of working with psychological experience. Reductive interpretations will kill it. That's why it's so dangerous to use a Freudian model with people in this boat. But what I would call an archetypal approach, where you don't look at cause, but you question purpose, and you don't stop questioning purpose until you've got an answer, and you don't assume responsibility for the act, you don't feel guilty because of what's happened to you, then this process can evolve. So the practical point of our working with the Book of Job is that we learn the clinical attitude necessary to heal people who have been assaulted by evil. Those of you who work with kids, say, who have been abused, what's the first thing they say? My fault. My fault. This cost Jung every male friend he had. None of them could accept it. I think it is such a new point of view, and it goes in the face of our causal view of life, that at least at that time, the average masculine mind couldn't follow it. But that's what we'll be doing. We'll be looking at the story. So part of the time we'll be going through the Book of Job, and part of the time we'll be looking at its practical relevance in treating what I might call transpersonal pain. Well, that's just the bare outline. What I want to do now is just go through Blake's drawings. They're just beautiful. And kind of repeating what I've just said, but now each time we go through at a slightly more detailed level. I'm going to show you Blake's illustrations of the book of Job twice. First time I'm just going to go through them. They're in color and they're just pretty. So just let the images wash over you. And then the second time I go through it, I'm going to show you first a color image and then a black and white image from his etchings, which are not quite as aesthetically pleasing, but they're psychologically more intense and psychologically fuller. So that's what we'll talk about when we talk about in the etched versions. We'll come back to these and talk about what they all signify. Everybody see over me? That's just one time through quick. Now we'll go through it and look at the pictures and what they might be saying as that injury has worked with them. He calls this an image of an initial state of prosperity and contentment. The animals are asleep. The instruments are in the trees. There's an attitude of innocence. The instinctual, meaning the animals, and the cultural, spiritual energies are not functioning.
Not functioning.
Not functioning. Of course, now this is Blake's interpretation, but it's so close to Jung's. That's why we're going through it. Job is living by the book, backed up by institutional religion, cathedral in the background. The attitude of the picture is rightness. However, the sun is going down, and the moon is in its last phase. There's an atmosphere of comfort, because the individual's is unconsciously contained in his surroundings, in the family group, and in the community, and in material well-being. In other words, what defines the individual is found on the outside, in. But this Lord's Prayer, innocent and trusting attitude to God, is about to be sacrificed. The theme of the sacrifice is seen below, altar with the sacrificial fire. The altar gives rise to smoke, which surrounds the picture. Job is going to be the sacrifice. As the Blake wrote there, the letter killeth. That is, Job's reliance on the word, not the fire of the spirit, is about to be sacrificed. Job is reading and proclaiming the book. Above, action is activated. Yahweh has a book. He too is functioning by the book. However, Satan appears Yahweh in a stream of fire. In other words, doubts and questions which disturb the status quo and complacent living by the book will be activated. Yahweh and Satan plot to put Job to the test. Will Job remain loyal? Job has only known the benevolent aspect of Yahweh. Yahweh needs to be known it is in his totality, good and bad, hence the reference to Ion. Yahweh needs praise throughout the Old Testament. Only when the subject has no insight and needs an object to convince himself that he is there is the psychological state that this picture represents. So Yahweh in the Old Testament is consistently needing to be seen and mirrored. In modern language, that's pathological narcissism. So Yahweh, pathological narcissism. So Yahweh is a pathological narcissist. And that is the image of God on which our civilization is founded. That is about to be changed throughout this story. It's the self's need to be known in its totality that initiates the drama of Job, so that the leitmotif underneath all this is how our representation of God will change throughout these experiences. Now that, of course, is what we're looking at in the individual, but we'll also be looking at what that means for the religious views of the society. Pure explosive energy erupts, destroying the containing structure. So now the deed has been done between Yahweh and Satan, and Satan now is destroying Job's comfortable world. Satan erupts and destroys Job's children and his family. That's what's going on down here. And that would be the structures of the ego that are being trashed. So this image would represent the despair or the symptoms that follow such an encounter with the dark side of the self. I just did a close-up of Satan in the color and Satan in the black. I think it captures it a little better. That's why I decided to use this version. Arrival of bad news from the cathedral. See, this is going to have an effect on traditional religious thinking. It suggests a destruction of established religious structures. It is the traditional container of religious values that is being destroyed. And that would refer, I think, both to Jewish theology and to Christian theology. Neither theology can come to grips with the real meaning of this experience. Job's strength is that he continues to be true to his experience, even though it runs counter to tradition. Job reacts by emphasizing conventional values. He is distributing alms while Satan is about to force fire on him. Satan has the energy. Both Yahweh and Job look depressed. This is how we deal with chaos. Rather than confront it and understand its meaning, we split it off and flee to a conventional attitude, whether that be charity or rationality, but at a price. Satan has all the energy. Here, the limited adaptation breaks down. That's Job on his back, and Satan above it. All defenses have collapsed. In the right hand, in Satan's left hand, he's pouring boils over Job. But what I find so interesting, in the right hand, he's got four arrows. So what is really happening, he's being attacked by a quaternity. This is the road to a future reorganization of a more whole ego, if we don't reductively try to interpret it. The broken pitcher at the bottom is a warning. This could be too much for the ego. But what is being asked of Job and those who go through these experiences is to serve as a container for a fuller representation of the real nature of God. Look at the broken shepherd's crook on the lower left. It represents the loss of innocence, the loss of the Lord is my shepherd attitude. What is happening here doesn't square with the idea of Yahweh as a good shepherd. And then come the comforters, in quotes. And what they basically tell Job is, you know, God knows what he's doing. Buckle up. Edgar calls this an image of blackness and suicidal despair, where Job says, why did I not die newborn? Ultimate questions, however, have been asked. The rest of the story answers this despair. We could say that these bitter questions are the result of Job's being chosen to hold a fuller image of God. More of the comforter's rational commentary to Job. The picture in the upper left is an account of a dream which one of the comforters had, in which the dreamer said, was any man ever found faultless in the presence of God? So you see, that dream tries to put Job back in the old attitude, emphasizing the necessity of always scrutinizing our dreams from a larger perspective. More of the so-called comforters who are saying basically, you know, Job, you don't understand it, but God knows what he's doing. Accept this. And Job holds on to his experience. I did nothing wrong. I don't deserve this. And the key element again is that by holding on to his integrity, he becomes the vessel for a fuller manifestation of God. So I think this one's a little easier to see in color. Here's Yahweh You see, he's entwined now by the snake. So in the traditional interpretation, the snake is evil in the Garden of Eden, and Yahweh is good. But here, those two opposites are coming together. Yahweh and God are Satan, or Yahweh and evil, are coming closer to each other. And if you notice, even Yahweh has got a cloven hoof. He's not even completely human. That is a fuller representation of the image of God than either can be symbolized by Judaism or Christianity. Maybe by any religion. That's why I think this material is so important.
But is Job not wanting to look at that? Is that why his face is turned away?
Well, what energy makes of it is that he's looking down into the depths of hell. So what he's how he experiences this is as hell. And all, of course, the other main image here is the fire. Actually, the fire doesn't show up so clearly there. It does a little better there. And of course, here you can see how clear Yahweh is pointing to the tablet of the law, but the real energy is in the union of the snake and Yahweh and the fire. Now, a fourth person enters scene, which Energy takes to mean the beginning of the response of the psyche to the creative production of an inner wholeness, also indicated by the stars. Stars, as you might know, can typically represent fate. That's what astrology assigns them to. They're typically symbolic of Sophia, who is also an image of fate. So that the real essence of Job now is starting to emerge in that fourth figure who's coming on the scene, and the presence of the stars. Then Yahweh appears. The traditional interpretation is that that just shows that we should shut up and let God, let Father knows best, so to speak. But as far as Jung is concerned, the meaning of that is that it's the attitude of Job holding fast to his knowledge of his innocence that allowed this manifestation to occur. Because of Job's moral behavior, God was forced to reveal himself. In other words, that this, if we now take it as a metaphor, that in these processes, the self will reappear after this dark night of the soul, if the ego can maintain its attitude. So that then that new emergence of selfhood is depicted by the return on a large scale of number four.
Large scale, I'm sorry.
Of the number four. So, when Yahweh first appears, it's an unstructured, chaotic appearance, but now that experience is settling down, and what remains is the stability of a new four. So in this picture, Job is looking up and seeing that aspect of God. In the next picture, he's looking down and seeing that aspect of God, the bestial aspect of God. So the two opposites in the image of God or in the self are starting to come together. Now, they're Behemoth and Leviathan, two monsters. And the only place they appear in the Old Testament in the same book is in the book of Job. And Jung's understanding of that is an image of the bestial side of Yahweh. That's the amoral, immoral side of Yahweh, the side we saw in the cloven hoof, and the side that allowed Yahweh to get into a dialogue with the devil. And now Job is seeing both sides. Now this is not in the book of Job, but Blake throws it in. And I think one of the reasons Edinger turned to these series of pictures, because it is so psychologically accurate. What is happening is the self is getting cleansed of its unconscious evil, and Satan is being cast out of heaven. We don't see that in the Christian account, in the Jewish account. We do see in the New Testament, in Luke 10:18, Satan falling from heaven. But a separation now is starting to occur. Before, there was an unconscious mixture of Yahweh's goodness and evil, which is why it could function so unconsciously. Job is beginning to recognize that and cleanse the image of God out from its unconscious evil. In other words, the ego is reestablishing its strength. The ego, Yahweh and Job, or if we take it as a metaphor, the self and the ego are establishing a new relationship. And these figures turning, it doesn't show it so clearly in this one, but in this one it shows the figures with their backs to Yahweh. It's amazing how much more psychologically accurate the etchings are. Edinger interprets as the part of ourselves waiting integration in the future into this understanding. We're not quite ready to face it. I like this
better. Are those parts of his family, or because they keep on showing up? Are they comforters, or
what? No, they don't. As far as I know, they don't exist in the Bible. That's Blake's edition.
Okay, but they're always sitting by him, or something like that. Right?
Well, these are people now that are turning his back on what just happened. Another image of restoration. Another image of restoration. He's getting gifts of money and a ring, which would have represent the energy and the renewed commitment to himself that this process has initiated. And the grain would be the fruits of this ordeal, waiting to be harvested. Here he is with his daughters, indicating a new relation to the feminine. And finally, his prosperity is restored. A couple of the features that are different from the very first pictures: the animals are awake. the instruments are being played. They had been sitting, now they're standing. And again, the picture is framed by the smoke from the sacrificial altar, saying this is what the end point can be of the ordeal. And that's a quick trip through Blake and Job. Any questions?
No, we're done.
Well, so we have a stretch, and then we'll come back and pick up with a dream and the text.